Here's kind of the stage of fatherhood I'm at with two of our three are 4 years old and 2 years old. And here's just where we're at. If Marty so much as steps out of the room, these guys' radar is up. And she's sneaking out of the room just to go to the bathroom, right? And it's like, where's Mom? Well, she's in the bathroom. And it's like, okay. You know, and it's like, no. Like, she's okay. She doesn't need to see you right now. That's not what her life is about in this moment. You can leave her alone, okay? And they don't get that. They don't want that. They want to be right there, whatever Mom's doing. Oh, Mom's at the gym? Well, why didn't she take us? On the other hand, I can sit there in the room and I can announce, guys, I'm leaving for the day. You're not going to see me again until 5 o'clock. Or Daddy's got a trip. I'm going to be gone for 2 days in New York. And they don't even look up from, like, iPads, iPhones, TVs, coloring pages, anything. Like, not even to acknowledge. So I start this off to say, I know that we have many fathers of young children in our church and in our community. And sometimes it feels like what you're doing day in and day out is just being ignored. That any impact that you're having is almost imperceptible. Day after day, it's like, am I making any difference in my kid's life at all? And I thought of this as we were hiking the last couple of weeks, that you've hiked in the mountains of Colorado. Sometimes you're going up or down a steep hillside. And what they do is they create these switchbacks, right? Just like the road. So instead of going straight up, you can kind of zigzag up or down. And what do you inevitably see on those kinds of trails is that people have started to make cut-throughs, that people realize the trail's just right up there or the trail's just right down there. And instead of going all the way out there and all the way back, they just cut through. And the first couple people do that because they see a quicker way up or a quicker way down, and it seems like nothing happens. But then some short time later, you realize there's a new trail there. And, you know, the Parks and Rec are actually out there erecting signs saying, hey, we're trying to revegetate this area. Please don't walk through here. And what you realize is that these repeated behaviors have created paths to follow. And so I want to encourage you as fathers that even in this stage where it's like it's all about Mom or it's all about a school teacher or something else, and it seems like you're not making a difference, repeated behaviors are creating paths that your children will follow. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 this morning. And let me tell you what I'm reading. The Apostle Paul is writing to a church in Thessalonica. And we're going to come to verse 11 in the middle of this reading, or toward the end of this reading, where he talks about how he has a relationship with this church like a father has with his biological children. And so I'm going to use that verse as kind of a key to unpacking the rest of these 12 verses around it to say, if Paul is saying, I'm like a godly father with his children, then what is this godly father with his children doing? So let's read 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 1. For you yourselves know, brothers, that our coming to you was not in vain. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. For our appeal does not spring from error or impurity or any attempt to deceive. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please man, but to please God, who tests our hearts. For we never came with words of flattery, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from people, whether from you or from others, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil. We worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaimed to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how holy and righteous and blameless was our conduct toward you believers. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. This is the word of the Lord. We're going to see in this text this morning a father's commitment, a father's character, a father's conduct, and a father's charge, where Paul leaves off verses 11 and 12. So a father's commitment is where this text begins. And by commitment, I think it's really easy to read this text, read it through a couple times. And what jumps out at me is that this father, Paul, is really, really passionate about a few key things. And that's what I mean by commitment, that this is what he is committed to. This is what he is living for. And he's showing us three things here, fathers. Number one, you see Paul's commitment. You see a father's commitment to the gospel. And most of you know that the gospel means good news. But right here in this text, or if you just rewind a couple verses before this text, you see what Paul is talking about. You see this relentless commitment to the gospel. Verses 2, verse 4, verse 8, verse 9. He's repeatedly going back to these brothers and sisters and sons and daughters of his spiritually. And he's saying, what is my ultimate commitment to? It's to Jesus Christ and the gospel. And if you go back to chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, you realize the good news is that the Father, God the Father, has delivered you from worthless idols, from vain things that you might worship, that you might give all your attention to, but in the end they do nothing for you except leave you under wrath because you've sinned. And you have no substitute, you have no answer for the sin that you've committed. And he says, but the good news is the Father did something to rescue you from the idolatry, to rescue you from wrath, and he did it through his Son, Jesus Christ. So positively, he says in verses 9 and 10 of the previous chapter, he says positively, the gospel, the good news is you have an opportunity to live with the living and true God for all eternity, to be reunited as sons and daughters, adopted home. OK, so that's what the gospel is that he's committed to. You can also see it in chapter 5, verses 9 and 10. He says, for God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we might live with him. And he's saying, this is the good news I'm committed to, that whether we die before God comes back for us or whether we live, we can be with the Father forever because the wrath has been removed by Jesus Christ dying for us. And he's relentlessly committed to sharing this good news, to living this good news, to enjoying this good news. Secondly, you see the Father's commitment to being a God pleaser. Verse 4. He literally says, we speak not to please man, but to please God. And he goes on, verses 5 and 6. We never came with words of flattery, nor did we seek glory from people. And you understand what you're doing with flattery? When you're flattering someone, it sounds maybe on the surface like affirmation. But affirmation is really a giving of yourself to build up someone else. And it's sincere, right? There are sincere ways to encourage and to affirm, to say thank you, to give praise to someone who's doing well, like your children. But flattery is when you are manipulating circumstances. It's insincere. It's more about you. And what can I get back from these people by speaking the way I am? They'll, you know, butter them up and then I can get what they want or what I want. And you see what Paul is saying here is that one of the fundamental commitments of my life as a father is I'm not even trying to please you. I'm not even trying to please the kids. You know, you see that in our culture where a lot of times fathers are just kind of like, well, what's going to make the kids happy? What's going to pacify the kids? And Paul's saying that's not what I'm ultimately about. My commitment is what is going to please God. And if he is the audience of one that is watching my life, that is either honored by my life or dishonored by my life, it is pleasing God. That is my ultimate commitment. But then thirdly, I want you to notice this father's commitment to the local church. And that may fly off the radar because it's simply, he's not saying it explicitly, but it's the context for everything Paul is saying. You realize that as he's going, first of all, to plant this church from scratch and bring Jews and Gentiles together and teach the gospel, teach the good news, and then form a church out of that. And then he continues in his travels and he's saying, even though there's conflict, even though there are barriers, even though I have suffered persecution, I long to come to you and to continue to build you up in your faith. And you see Paul's relentless commitment to the local church. You see it even in the language that he uses here, that he's referring to them as brothers and sisters. He's referring to them as his children, his sons and daughters. And so he's thinking of his family, not just as his narrow biological family, but he's thinking of his family as this is the family of Christ. These are my mothers and fathers. These are my brothers and sisters. These are my sons and daughters. I think of our culture today and think, is this what fathers are committed to? Even Christian fathers. Are your kids watching you and they're saying, you know what? My father, my dad is committed to the gospel. My father is committed to relentlessly pleasing God and serving the local church. That's what my dad is passionate about. By the way, do you know in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10, Paul actually writes that God is displaying his manifold wisdom, which is a way of saying, you know, you look in the sky this time of year when it's raining over here and there's a rainbow in the sky. And it's many different colors, many, many colors of the rainbow. It's across the spectrum. Manifold means kind of like that, across the spectrum. So across the spectrum of God's grace, across the spectrum of God's wisdom, he says, I'm specifically displaying that through the local church. And he actually says the angels in heaven are looking on at what Jesus Christ is doing in the local church. And they are in awe that God can take people who are so different from each other, so unreconciled, so at odds, so at conflict, different races, different genders, different classes, different political parties, and bring them together in one gospel serving one God. Are we as fathers committed to that grace, that picture of what God is doing? Now, that's my whole first point. And so you could sit there as fathers or even as others and you could say, it seems like something's missing. It seems like if you're going to say, what is a father committed to? Wouldn't you say like the father is committed to his kids? And the answer is yes. And I think that's implied. But what Paul is showing us here are the ultimate commitments that make the commitments to our families actually work. So I could put it like this, you know, who's your favorite Broncos player? That's not funny. She said Tom Brady. I'll see you two afterward. At least he went to Michigan, so I can get on board with that. But otherwise, no. Okay, so Von Miller. I did not hear that, but you're all thinking Von Miller besides these two. So Von Miller, let's say Von Miller has this. Let's say he has this commitment. He wants to be a world-class linebacker in the NFL. But he's not willing to be committed to reading the playbook. He's not willing to commit to lifting weights. He's not willing to commit to eating lots of protein. He's not willing to commit to take time off to let his body rest and recover. You would realize, okay, this guy who doesn't listen to his coaches, he doesn't rest, he doesn't lift, he doesn't read the playbook, he may be committed to being the best linebacker in the NFL, but he's not going to be. And this is kind of the picture of what Paul is doing here, is he's saying, I can leave it out because, of course, if you do these behaviors, if you have these core commitments, you're going to be really good at what you do. And what Christ is giving us ultimately here in this text is saying, if you are committed to the gospel and to honoring Jesus Christ above everyone else and saying, I know that what I'm doing or thinking or saying may displease these people in my life, but I'm not here to please these people. I'm committed to pleasing Jesus Christ. I'm committed to being a part of the local church. Those are the behaviors that make you a healthy father, so that as you are just kind of implied committed to your children, you are pointing them to something that can actually lead them and grow them. And by the way, what is the alternative to being committed to these things? As dads, what's the alternative? If you're not committed to these things as a father, you'll be committed to something else. And, you know, we think of, family man in our culture. People say he's a good family man. Well, generally, what does our culture mean by a good family man? They mean a guy that likes spending time with his kids, probably doing sports. They're hiking, they're camping, they're fishing, shooting guns, they're skiing, boating, they're doing music and theater together, they're doing vacation and travel together. And they're like, that is a good family man. But dads, if your idea of being a good family man is not revolving around a commitment to the things that God calls us to be committed to. You may be the funnest dad in the world, but what are you reproducing in terms of fatherhood? It's interesting that our kids can look at, and these are the next two points, our kids can look at a father's character and a father's conduct, and they immediately know, this is what my dad is committed to. And if we're honest, we can say that a lot of fathers, even Christian fathers, are committed to making money. They're committed to their career. They're committed to having fun and vacationing and traveling. They're committed to their reputation. They're committed to their opinions. Like, they always have to be right and somehow prove that they're right and everyone else is wrong, even at the risk of destroying other people. They're so committed to these things, but they're not committed to the gospel and to pleasing God and to the local church. I just wonder, why would a Christian father ever point his kids to being passionate about sports and camping and fishing instead of being passionate about the good news of Jesus Christ, living to honor God, and helping build up the local church, the bride of Christ? Now, as I said, your kids will know what your commitments are to through your character and your conduct. That's the next thing. Let's notice the father's character here, because Paul's going to call attention to a couple qualities here. And before I show you what he says in the text, I want you to just think, what are generally in our culture, Western culture, kind of urban, progressive, what are some of the character qualities that we often see in fathers in our culture today? You know, and I'm not even saying that these are the ones that we intentionally honor. I'm just saying by default, these are the ones we see over and over again in fatherhood. I mean, if the memes on social media mean anything, I was just skimming through some this week. And what you see kind of lampooned all the time is that men in our culture, dads in our culture, are selfish, proud, lazy workaholics. And I was thinking how completely countercultural the three traits that Paul lists here are for fathers. Because the first thing he points out, verse 8, is that a father is affectionate. And I'm choosing that word on purpose because if I were to ask for a show of hands and say, how many fathers love your kids? I mean, I think you would all raise your hand and say, of course I love my kids. And sometimes even when as dads we're swinging back and forth between like appeasing our kids and ignoring them, and then we feel bad for ignoring them, so we go back to appeasing, and then we've done that too much, so we start ignoring. You know, and there's this, you see this in culture, right? That these dads are doing it, like, I'm really plugged into my career and making money and work and having fun and doing the things I want to do, and my kids are out of control, so I swing back over here and appease them. And those fathers would all say, I love my kids. So I'm choosing a more specific word that Paul uses here in verse 8, affectionately desirous. And what Paul's saying there is a father is not just mailing it in. But he's saying there's an affection, there's a heartfelt love in me that drives me to be with my kids in a particular way, doing certain kinds of behaviors. And this is going to sound weird to us, but verse 7, he says, like a nursing mother taking care of them. And you got a father saying like a nursing mother. Paul is just simply saying, if you look at the way a mother is with a nursing child, holding them close, like literally feeding them and nourishing them and cherishing them, Paul's saying, you know, you can be a strong man and have that kind of tender, affectionate relationship with your kids. You know, I kind of picture, you see wild animals like wolverines or bears or, you know, whatever. And these animals, like they would rip you apart. If you're hiking through the mountains, you run across a mountain lion, the mountain lion wants to rip you to pieces, or at least rip your dog to pieces. But what does that mama cougar, what does that mama bear do with her own little cubs? She can hover over them and use all of her strength to protect them tenderly. And that's kind of the picture that Paul gives us here as a father. You can be strong and you can be bold and courageous and all that, but that strength is hovering over those kids and it's protecting and providing and cherishing and nourishing those children. That's affection. The second quality he lists here, verse 8, is selflessness or being selfless. Verse 8, he says, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves. And I love that because what he's saying is, obviously this good news that I'm giving to you is the ultimate life-saving thing. You need to encounter Jesus in the gospel and his grace and trust. That's all important. But he's saying, you know what else I'm going to give you with that is I'm going to give you me. I'm going to give you all of me. And we say this usually around Christmas time, but fathers, you know your kids need your presence. P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Your presence. Not your presence, your gifts. And giving your children gifts and giving your children little things here or there, even speaking words of truth to your kids, is not a substitute for a selfless self-giving. I was driving somewhere this week, coming back from a meeting in the tech center, I think. I had the radio on, and there was a local talk show host that he didn't realize that today was Father's Day. So this was a couple days back. And the other guy said, hey, what are you, and I won't say his name, but the other guy said, hey, what are you doing for Father's Day? And he's like, oh, I'm going to do what I always do. I'm going to go golfing. When is it? And the guy said, that's this Sunday. And he kind of launched into this whole diatribe, and he said, you know what? Father's Day, I'm the father. Father's Day is about me. I'm going to do what I want on Father's Day. That's been my pattern my whole life. My kids, some of them are more grown now. But he's like, this is what Father's Day is about because I'm the father. Father's Day is about me. And he said, the last thing I want to do on Father's Day is see my kids. So he said, I'm going to play 45 holes of golf, which is like 5 rounds of 9. Now, that's a lot of golf. But he literally said, this is what I do every year. I get away from my family. I don't want to see my kids. I play 45 holes of golf with my best friends, and it's awesome. Well, that's the very kind of selfishness that Paul is speaking against, that a true biblical father is selfless. I'm not saying you don't take time for yourself away from your kids to kind of recharge sometimes, because sometimes you need that. You need a break. They're driving you nuts. I get that. But is even that selfless because you're recharging so you can come back and give them not only the gospel of God, but your own self? Finally, and again, countercultural, Paul points out that a biblical father is not just affectionate and selfless, but he's righteous. Verse 10. I'm summarizing three words here. He uses the word holy, the word righteous, and the word blameless. And those three words just simply picture a person who's completely devoted to obedience to Christ. My character is such that something of paramount importance to me as a dad is that I'm in the Word of God and I am super committed to doing what I can by the Spirit living in me to walk in obedience to Christ. And I'll just leave those words up there for a moment and just think to yourselves, can you imagine what kind of transformative, caring effect we could have as dads, not just on our own children, but on culture, if those three words, affectionate, selfless, and righteous, is what characterized men in the church? That we're not sitting back, let the women do the loving, let them be affectionate. But it's no, like, guys are like, nope. I'm going to use my strength to comfort and protect and provide for those who are weaker than me. You know, that's what God calls men to do. You don't use your strength for yourself. You use it for others, affectionately, selflessly, righteously. Well, let's go on here, because beyond the commitments of a father and the character of a father, he shows us three things by way of a father's conduct. And I think the preeminent one here, and this is maybe going to sound odd when I first say it, but the first thing I see here is evangelism. Because we typically think of evangelism as like, that's what that one guy with that gift does, like preaching in the tent revival thing. He's evangelizing others. But the word evangelism is simply the proclamation of good news. So look at this. Verse 2. Paul pictures himself as a father with his children declaring the gospel. Verse 4, speaking the gospel. Verse 8, sharing the gospel. Verse 9, proclaiming the gospel. He uses four different words to kind of come out from these different angles, saying one of the preeminent things I'm doing as a father is sharing the gospel in real life with my spiritual offspring. And I want to say, fathers, we are here to partner with you in sharing the gospel with your kids. And we want to see this community evangelized by something that we do directly to try to reach them. But, you know, it's no one else's ultimate responsibility to evangelize your kids than yours. And I'm not saying you actually save your kids. I want you to understand, we're not talking about outputs. We're talking about inputs. You control inputs. You do not control outputs. So God is calling you to input into your kid's life the gospel. You know, you talk about it. You share it. As you're going, going on that hike and going on that fishing trip and skiing and biking and all those things, you're looking for different ways to share the gospel in real life, inputting the right kind of message, the right kind of hope, the right kind of life, the right kind of grace. So you can't save your children, but you can certainly lead them to Christ through the inputs you have in their lives. So that's evangelism. Secondly, verse 12, you see exhortation. So this is an interesting word where he says, we exhorted each one of you. The actual etymology of this word is to come alongside someone. Para, alongside, like a para teacher comes alongside a teacher to help. Kaleo, to call. So this is someone who's called alongside, but what are they coming alongside to do? They're coming alongside with grace and with empathy, but also with truth. I think Tim Keller's definition of this word is kind of the easiest one for me to understand. He says this exhortation is a sympathetic, loving insistence on the truth. A sympathetic, loving insistence on the truth. And sometimes you see fathers who are sympathetic and loving and kind of tolerant. And then you see other fathers who are like insisting on the truth. And they're very bold and they're very brash and like, kids, just do this. And this word marries those two things together, where it's sympathy and love. But I'm absolutely insisting on the truth in your life. So I'll give you an example. The other day we had some friends over. We're sitting in the back. I think we're grilling out on the back patio. And our two-year-old is over there. We have these big, tall trees in our backyard. Well, tall for Stapleton. They're short trees. Tall for Stapleton. They're like, 12 feet tall or something. And they're covered with these little tiny flowers. And all summer long, there are like a trillion bees on each plant. And Miles is over there with baseball bats and golf clubs and tennis rackets and all kinds, just whacking the bees. And he sees a bee and bam, and wha-cha. And he's like hacking this plant all to pieces, trying to get at the bees. And I kept telling him, okay, you need to stop. You're going to get hurt. These bees, you're going to get the bees mad, and the bees sting when they're mad, right? And he wouldn't stop. And so I had to do this sympathetic, loving insistence on the truth. So the sympathetic part is coming alongside him and saying, okay, I get it. You're two. You're this tall. You're looking at this swirling thing of like little targets. And it seems really fun. So I can sympathize with that you want to clobber these little bad boys. But the other thing I sympathize about is that bee stings really hurt. And so I'm going to insist that you stop, including taking the golf clubs away from you and putting them back in the bin. Okay, that's kind of like this exhortation. I love you. I sympathize with you. I see what's going on, but I insist that you do the right thing. I insist that you do the thing that's good for you. That's exhortation. Third thing, same verse, is encouragement. And this is another interesting word. We have the same para alongside, but then it's more a picture of coming alongside to urge, to encourage, to insist on, but not in a exhortation sort of insisting. It's more like the consoling, comforting kind of insisting. So the way I'd illustrate this is going back to when I was first learning to rock climb in the mountains of North Carolina and had this friend. And I was not scared of heights. Like, I could stand on top of really high things and think this is cool. But there's just something about putting your life out there on this little tiny rope. And I'm climbing, and I get stuck at this one spot. And most of my body weight was on one leg. So anybody ever done this with rock climbing? So you're like standing on a toe, and you're hanging on, and you've climbed a ways, and all that weight's on this toe. And this combination of fear and fatigue starts to set into this leg, and what happens? This leg starts shaking really badly, and you're like, and everybody down below, and you're like, I'm good. So my friend Brian did this encouragement, what this word is. He's watching and he's saying, at the same time, he's saying, you know what? You're not going to fall. You're not going to fall. Like, I know my equipment. My equipment can hold a grand piano. You are not a grand piano. You're going to be fine. But then also, like, because I'm stuck and I can't find the next handhold, and it's like my second time climbing, is that he's like, I'm going to give you a little assist. And he pulls, because we're top rope. He pulls and, like, pulls me up a couple feet as I'm reaching and get to the next thing. And that's a picture of what Paul is saying fathers do, is that there's this insistence, this encouragement, this spurring on, but comforting at the same time. So you've got evangelism, exhortation, encouragement. And I want to just pause here for a moment and say, dads, if you were to take all the conduct of your interactions with your kids and try to put it in three categories, what three categories would you land on? Would you say, yeah, I'm evangelizing them. I'm showing them the gospel. I'm exhorting them. I'm doing this sympathetic, loving insistence on the truth. And I'm also doing that. I spur you on and I comfort you. And even as I'm spurring you on, I'm giving you that assist that gets you to the next place where God is leading you to go. Because that's a biblical picture of what fathers, Christian fathers, should be up to in our kids' lives. Let's go to this and I'll close. A father's charge. So you notice this is verse 12. We see these words again that I just addressed. We exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you. We don't use that word charged much anymore. We may, you know, when we ordain someone or something like that, or couples getting married, we may say we're giving a charge to the bride and groom. So what we're doing is we're insisting on something in their lives. We're giving them an exhortation that will help them. But I want you to think of a charge as an insistence. And by the way, dads, if you're not insisting on something in your kids' lives, then what in the world are you doing? If something is really that important to you, you are not going to be ambivalent about whether or not you pass that on to your kids. It's not going to be like, well, I have built my life around Jesus Christ and the gospel and the local church, but you know, I just want to leave my kids to make their own decisions. I don't want to be dogmatic. I just want to let them kind of feel their way. Well, baloney. I mean, I know that's what culture tells you to do, but if something is core and central to you, that'd be like you saying, I discovered the cure for cancer and my son has cancer, but I don't want to insist on, you know, putting my cure on my son, because just let him figure out his own cure. No, I mean, you'd be like, that's crazy. Wait, you're telling me you have something to deliver from death to life, and your kid is dying, and you're not going to insist that he take the medicine that you've discovered? I mean, this is what Paul is always doing. He's like, you know, I'm not trying to offend you. I love you. I'm affectionate towards you. But I insist that you listen to what I'm saying, and I insist that you take this medicine of the gospel. So the father's charge here is crystallized in verse 12. I've underlined this in my Bible. He says, I've charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. I want you to notice the order there, where he's saying, I'm urging you, I'm charging you, I'm insisting that you walk in a manner worthy of God, who has already called you into his kingdom and glory. Okay, so what he presents is gospel fatherhood versus legalistic fatherhood. Legalistic fatherhood would look like this. You take your Bible, you find all the rules. Don't do these things, do these things. Then you're a good Christian. God will accept you. Then you're worthy of God. Well, he's not saying make yourself worthy of God. He's saying you walk in a manner worthy of God, who has already done these things for you. So you think of it this way. He talks about two things, the kingdom and glory of God that you have entered into the experience of already by faith. Okay, if we back up and think about this, we're talking about the splendor, the majesty, the brightness, the power, the glory of an eternal God who made everything by speaking. Okay, you cannot experience that in a broken condition. I mean, that's like staring into 1,000 suns and saying that you enjoy that. That's like standing beneath 1,000 Niagara Falls and saying that you enjoy that. You don't. The weight of that, the power of that, the brilliance of that is more than any of us can bear. Nobody can enjoy the reign of a king. This is the other word, the kingdom. You've entered into the kingdom. You enjoy the kingdom. Well, nobody can enjoy the reign of a king who knows everything about you and is just. Because if a king has that kind of authority and that kind of power and that kind of knowledge of your life, and he's just, and he sits on the throne, and he says, okay, you've done these things, you've failed to do these other things, you are guilty, okay, end of story. So you look back at this and say, how in the world did we enter into the kingdom and the glory in the first place? And he shares here in this letter It's because God called or invited us in. That's what he says here. Verse 12. Walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you, who invites you into his own kingdom and glory. How did God call you or invite you into staring at 1,000 suns and standing beneath 1,000 Niagaras? And the answer is by the mercy of the cross. That this Father who knows everything about you, this King who knows everything and is just, he actually put that sin on himself, on Jesus Christ, and he was punished. He died. That's what the cross is about. So we're going to remember in a few moments here as we go back to communion, that we have that adoption as sons and daughters with the Father because Jesus Christ laid down his life on a cross and took what we deserved. And he rose up again. And then he covers you. It's like the most powerful sunglasses in the world. He's putting on you with his covering and saying, now look at my glory and enjoy it. You know, this covering that you can stand there and it's like plexiglass and you're seeing the power and the weight just pound down on you and you hear the roar and it's immense and you feel it in your body, but it's not affecting you because Jesus is taking it for you. And now Jesus is saying through Paul here, what is the Father's charge? Well, you walk in a manner worthy of the amazing grace that you've received. And so, you know, just a couple quick specific examples, like, you know, we're all trying to teach our kids forgiveness. We're trying to teach them to say little things like, I'm sorry and I forgive you. And there's a very legalistic way to do that. Just like, say you're sorry. Just say you're sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. You know, and you're like, okay, fine. Okay, good parenting. Well, we know that's not good parenting. Kids who just legalistically repeat these mantras of like, oh, I'm sorry. Well, okay, then I forgive you. And you know that they're not sorry and they haven't forgiven. They're going to grow up to teenagers and then adults who aren't sorry and aren't forgiving. But what we do in this walking worthy of the gospel is we're saying, you know, at an age appropriate level, kids, this is what you've done. This is how God has forgiven you. And what we're doing is saying now we forgive others because God has forgiven us. We forgive others through the forgiveness we've received. Because sometimes that sin against us, even as adults, is so incredibly painful. We're like, there is no way I can forget or forgive what he's done. But we can if we're walking worthy of this gospel that we've received and we're saying, I understand my own sin. I understand the forgiveness and the cleansing and the reconciliation that I've received. And kids, that's just how we live as Christians. Even if it's completely counter to every culture out there. You know, another example is generosity. You can make these wooden rules for your kids. We just give 10% of our income to the church. And that's great. That's in the Bible. Or you can teach them, let's look at how generous God has been with us. To give us his own son, to give us life and forgiveness and hope and freedom. All these things, like there's this pattern of generosity that's coming to us through the gospel. And so how do we live as a family? We live generously. We live open-handedly because that's how God has been with us. You see, the picture is what we're doing is we're taking the gospel and saying, because God has done these things freely, I charge you, kids, I insist that you walk in a way that is a reflection of the grace that you've received.